As part of her work as chief spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Melissa Fleming travels the world sharing the stories of Syrian refugees. She joins me now to tell one of those stories about Doa al-Zamal, a Syrian refugee who inspired Ms. Fleming to write a book called A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival. It is published by Flatiron Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Melissa Fleming to our show. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Tell us a little about Doa. Where in Syria did she grow up?
Well, the reason Doa's story is so representative of the whole Syria refugee crisis is she's actually from the town where the uprising began in Syria and where the protests started, the peaceful protests. She was out on the streets and witnessed how her government cracked down on peaceful protesters and was, you know, actually quite enraged. But also her family, a very simple family, who, you know, was just very loving and together and had a good living and were just...
Her father was a barber.
Her father was a barber, you know, a peaceful existence, a community that was very tight, all watched it unravel before her eyes and unravel in a very bloody way and so dangerous, including for her sisters, because women were being abducted, women were being raped, that they had to take the decision, the awful decision, to give up everything, their home, their community, and flee across the border and make it to Egypt.
Hadn't Dara, her hometown, always been considered a base of support for President Assad and his Ba'athist party?
Well, yes and no. You know, there's always around Syria there, it was very little chance for dissent over the years, including under his father. And dissent, as we saw and witnessed in history, was met with horrible violence and terrible death. So I think inspired by the Arab Spring and seeing that actually in other countries, people were taking to the streets, demanding democracy, demanding reforms. And what they were initially demanding was actually, you know, very simple steps to more freedom of speech, ability to demonstrate, lifting of the emergency law. What they didn't expect was the violent crackdown that took place.
I saw a recent documentary about how concerned the U.S. military is about climate change being a major factor in conflicts around the world. And you write, in 2007, a drought swept through the country, talking about Syria, lasting 3 years, forcing many farmers to move to Daraa to seek employment. Some believe that the displacement gave rise to the ripple of discontent in 2011.
Yes, there is that theory that you can link climate change, you can link terrible climate events, first of all, to the shifting of people. And if the governments don't address and help those people who are forced to move for climate reasons, there will be unrest. And if that unrest is not addressed, it could turn into violence and result in war. It's very difficult to prove, but we're seeing this around the world, drought, water, other forms of the results of climate change forcing, you know, being sparks that can lead to conflict.
And when there is unhappiness, this can exacerbate the situation.
Absolutely, yes.
Didn't Doa's family stay in Syria for almost 2 years after the violence initially broke out? Why did it take them so long to leave?
Nobody wants to leave their home. And everybody thought, you know, this is going to be over. I mean, you know, there's no way that this is going to turn into a war. We'll hold it out. We have our home. We have our livelihood. Doa's father, you know, kept going to his barbershop, and even though it was really actually in the middle of the fighting, in the cross fighting, he just went day after day. A bomb fell. He walked into the barbershop, and there was half of it was destroyed, and he continued to receive a customer until they looked out the window and saw a tank coming, and the customer with half-cut hair jumped from his seat and left. And that evening when Doa's father returned home, they witnessed a man who was just completely depleted because he realized that he could no longer support his family. And not only that, that his daughter's lives were in danger. And so that's when they took finally the decision. They just said, in order to protect our daughters, we have to leave the country.
How old was Doa at the time?
Well, she was only 16 at the time, and she did not want to leave. She really felt strongly that she wanted to stay and be part of this movement that she felt very inspired by, but also just felt was really, really important.
They live close to the Jordanian border,
yes.
So they drove from Syria to Jordan, but then they went to Egypt.
Yes. Egypt at that time the president was Mohamed Morsi. The government was Muslim Brotherhood, and they were being demonstratively and verbally very welcoming towards Syrian refugees. So it was a wonderful, actually, kind of moment. It's awful to arrive across the border. It's awful to arrive, and you have only a suitcase to your name, very little money, an address to go to, you know, long, long, long trips, and have no idea what future is in sight. But then to be welcomed by officials and to say, you know, you're our brothers and sisters. We understand that you're fleeing war. Welcome. This is something that does not happen in many places in the world, and they were initially welcomed until events changed in Egypt and things got worse.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood would have been opposed to Assad because of religious and political reasons. But Morsi also became a problem as the ruler of Egypt, and he was toppled.
He was toppled, and there was a coup. And in a way, and because the Syrians were so welcomed by that government, they were also associated with the government, and they were denounced on media, on prominent an anchorman said that the Syrian refugees are complicit, and the mood changed overnight, and people who were once smiling and greeting them in the streets, Egyptians, were now looking at them with disdain or just not meeting their eyes, and so it was. It was really scary, again, to all of a sudden, from one day to the next, feel, welcome, and then to feel a hostility that sounded familiar, but that even in a foreign land. And so it was really, really difficult. And I think one of the things about the book that I wanted to show is not just how, how difficult it is to be a refugee and to have lost everything, but how difficult it is to try to pick up the pieces of your life in a foreign country with very little aid and assistance.
Doa had gone back to school.
Doa had tried to go back to school, and so had her brother and her younger sisters. It wasn't easy there either. I mean, at one point, Doa's brother was made, as a Syrian, to sit on the floor while the other students had desks. And, there were lots of complaints, and this was soon turned around, but they were faced with discrimination and also harassment. The girls were followed. They really felt scared being out on the streets. That kept getting worse until.
And were they easily spotted as Syrian refugees?
It's funny. There's a way I couldn't probably tell the difference, but there's a different way of dressing, and there's definitely a different accent. It's not terribly obvious, but in fact, Syrians are considered to be very beautiful people. And very, people are very attracted to them. So,
was Egypt the only country that was welcoming the refugees at this point?
No. In fact, I really want to give recognition to the other neighboring countries, Jordan, Lebanon, which is a tiny country. It has only 4 million people. It welcomed 1 million Syrian refugees. And so, at the beginning, Turkey also welcomed, hundreds of thousands of refugees. And it is really understandable that welcome has worn off after 6 years of conflict, particularly because the contribution from the international community has just simply not been enough.
Well, Egyptian politics played a role in them feeling that they had to leave again. But wouldn't the same thing have happened in Lebanon with Hezbollah is supporting Assad?
In Lebanon, Syrian refugees are tolerated, but I think as the years go by and the numbers are so large, I don't think it's the sectarian thing is so much the issue. It's the issue of resources. It's the issue of 50% of Syrian refugees are not in school. There's this is an absolutely, you know, first of all, it's just wrong from a human rights point of view. I think it's strategically stupid from the international community, because you have this lost generation of Syrian children who could be going back as the architects, the engineers, the peacemakers of Syria, and now you have them languishing. And of course, the communities that are taking in all of these people, they're worried themselves, and they're not feeling supported. So, you know, there have been efforts to raise more money. It's just never enough to meet the needs. And the countries, you know, are saying, look, we're taking all of the burden. When a few refugees, okay, it was a million, come to Europe, the world starts taking notice. But proportionally, the numbers that came to Europe are just tiny compared to the numbers of refugees that the neighboring countries took in.
So Tawa and her fiancé, Bassem, decided to leave Egypt and go to Sweden. And we'll pick up on the story after we take a little break. My guest is Melissa Fleming, who is the chief spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She has written a book called A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival, published by Flatiron Books. Stay with us for more. We are back with Melissa Fleming, who is chief spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and she has written a book called A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival, published by Flatiron Books. Doa and her fiancé, Bassem, decided to leave Egypt for Sweden. Why Sweden?
Well, you know, Sweden became this kind of shining country in the sky for many refugees, just because at that time Sweden had a very open and welcoming stance and policy towards Syrians in particular, and so it was way before what we call the Europe refugee crisis, but it seemed like a destination where they would not only find peace, but where they could find either employment or education and restart their lives.
In order to get to Sweden, Doa and Bassem handed over all of their savings to smugglers and boarded a kind of a leaky fishing vessel.
Oh, yeah. You know, of course, these smugglers advertise that they're going on the equivalent of a cruise ship. And, you know, they were not that naive, and they knew it was going to be bad, but they never imagined it was going to be like this. 500 people crammed on the boat, you know, shoulder to shoulder, feet to feet, and 100 of them were children. And the boat just looked like, you know, it was rusty and leaky, and it was just absolutely frightening when they finally got there. And the smugglers were treating them almost like animals.
And then after 4 terrifying days at sea, another ship, which was filled with angry men. Why were they angry? They,
you know,
rammed into the boat?
This will remain a mystery forever, I'm afraid. But they were all very hopeful. They'd been 4 days at sea, and the captain had just told them, in 17 days, you are going to reach Italy. That Italy would be the first shore. And, you know, the passengers, of course, they were weary. They hadn't slept. The kids were sick. But they all
17 days, a long time to go from Egypt to Italy.
Sorry, not days. Excuse me, 17 hours. 17 hours. So they had gone 4 days, and they only had 17 hours left, and they started breaking out in song, and there was a lot of cheer, and they thought, oh, finally, we could, you know, this is even less than a day. When they saw this boat coming from the distance and going very fast and full of about 10 angry men who had, you know, wood in their hands and started hurling the wood at the boat and shouting terrible insults at the refugees. And basically, one of them was, let the fish eat your flesh. Hmm. And, yeah, of course, they had no real time to think when they felt that the boat had been rammed into and people just started falling, and including Doa and, you know, she and Bassem, you know, grasped onto the side of the boat. When the boat, you know, swerved around and then came back and rammed again, and this time rammed a hole in the side of the boat, just under where Doa and Bassem were on the top deck.
And Bassem, among others, drowned.
Well, Bassem, not initially, but, you know, one thing is really important to know is that Doa had, you know, mortal fear of the water. So convincing her, she'd had a near-drowning experience at age 6. So convincing her to go on this boat was just, you know, her worst nightmare, and then it was happening. He slipped into the water. She lost the grip. She's holding on. around her, the people below deck were just doomed. And when finally the boat sank and Doa found herself in the water, Bassem swam up to her with a child's floating ring, you know, the kind we put our toddlers on in swimming pools. And she's a very slight young woman, and she gets on, 19-year-old woman at this time, gets on this child's floating ring with her arms and legs dangling over the side, and Bassem is treading water. And initially, there were only 100 survivors. And that number, by day two in the water, Bassem was not able to hang on any longer. And she watched as the love of her life drowned in front of her eyes.
And she wound up caring for two infants.
Yes, just before Bassem died, a grandfather, he was a Palestinian from Gaza, swam up to Doa and Bassem with a tiny infant. Her name was Malik, and she was only 7 months old, on his shoulder. And he said to Doa and Bassem, "Please take this child. I've lost 27 members of my family. I am not going to survive, and I entrust this child to you." And part of having little Malik on Doa, she placed Malik on her heart. And, you know, during this whole time of Bassem's struggle and her trying to convince him to keep holding on, "We are going to get to Sweden, Bassem, please, you're the love of my life." And he's saying, "I'm really sorry I put you in this, Doa. I never meant this to happen, but you have to stay strong and you have to survive." And she then, because she had this baby, you know, it was just absolutely dead. What she wanted to do was follow Bassem into the water and drown herself, but the baby kept her alive. And one day later, another mother approached her and offered her, not offered, but also said, "We're not, look, my 6-year-old has just drowned. My husband and I are not going to make it. And please take little Masa." And Masa was 18 months old, so she had two babies.
That was a lot of weight to put on that little floating
device. And of course, the whole time she's scared that they're going to, there were waves and there were, you know, the number of survivors kept dwindling. And of course, they're becoming more desperate and also wanted to hang on. And she had to just really make sure that those babies were protected and just pray and hold out hope that rescue would come.
How long before they were rescued?
4 days and nights in the water. And, you know, the nights were cold and foggy and scary. And, I hate to describe this, but, you know, there were corpses that were, you know, bobbing up against her. It just frightening beyond belief. And then when the sun came out, it was actually at first very nice, but it was hot. And they had no food and no water. And, you know, she's giving, you know, her saliva, you know, from her fingertips to little Masa and Malik, and singing them, you know, fairy tale songs and saying words to them from the Quran and just praying. And they're losing, of course, their strength. And yeah. But then, you know, on the fourth morning, she saw up above an airplane, and that was the first hope that she had that she'd been spotted. But then the plane went away for several hours, and then finally in the distance, she saw this huge merchant ship that was like a chemical tanker. You know, she was a speck in the water compared to this, and she started yelling for her life.
Did she and the two kids make it to Sweden?
Well, yes. I mean, incredibly, when, you know, she and the two babies were pulled on the boat, you can imagine. And I interviewed the captain and some of the crew, who they were just absolutely astonished. They could not believe that they could survive, and they did everything. They were just, you know, they had put them, but little Malik, unfortunately, she was still alive. And Doa even said she thought she had smiled, but she passed away on the deck of the boat. But Doa and Masa and 9 other survivors of 500 who were on that boat were rescued. Doa and Masa were taken to Crete and eventually have restarted their lives separately in Sweden.
How is Doa doing now? I would assume that something like this could easily give you PTSD.
Well, you know, it's absolutely, you know, traumatizing. She's one of the strongest women I've ever met, I have to say. I can't believe she has gone through all of that and remains so strong. She's learning Swedish. She's been kind of the binding force in her family, and she has real goals. She really wants to this book to speak out for the plight of her people and for people to recognize that everybody is a human being and everybody just wants peace and a dignified place to live. And she's ready to fight for that, to study, maybe
she's
to become a lawyer.
Yeah.
She hopes, yeah. First, she has to learn Swedish, which
But what
you
about
can imagine.
The rest of her family? Are they gone?
Well, she had left her mother and father and three siblings back in Egypt, and these awful smugglers, these gangs, were threatening them because, you know, they didn't want Doa. They knew they'd done, I mean, this was mass murder on the high sea, and they didn't want her talking. And so they were threatening her daughter, you know, her sisters, and so UNHCR, my organization, has a wonderful program. It's called Resettlement. It works with other countries and helps vulnerable refugees restart a new life in those countries. And they actually get on an airplane. So the same day, it was around this time last year, Doa was in Crete. She hadn't seen her mother for over a year and her family. And her mother and her father and their siblings, they got on a plane in Cairo, Doha and Crete, and they ended up on the same evening in a small, snowy, freezing little village in northern Sweden and were able to embrace for the first time. And that's where they live now, and that's where they've restarted their lives.
And when did you first learn the story, and when did you first meet Doha?
Well, I learned the story, you know, just after her rescue. I read about it in the press, and I thought, you know, my job is communications, and there's this saying that goes, you know, statistics are human beings with the tears dried off. And I think one can go even further than that. People see refugees too much as statistics, as masses, and they don't see the individual. And I meet refugees all the time, and the people I meet, every single time I say, I can't believe you survived that. I can't believe you survived that war. And I can't believe, and I find your resilience so remarkable. We've lost everything, and you know, and I try to find these stories that will represent the bigger picture. And Doha's for me, it represented everything. You know, what the Syria war was all about, why refugees were forced to flee, what life was like as a refugee, the very difficult life of as a refugee, what compels refugees to take these dangerous journeys to risk their lives again across the Mediterranean Sea, and just the strength of the human spirit. I mean, I find it extremely inspiring, and I hope the readers of this book will also find it inspiring.
Are you concerned about the anti-immigrant sentiments that we're seeing throughout Europe and the United States?
Absolutely concerned. I find it, you know, there have been politicians across Europe and also here who have been using the fears, exploiting the fears of potential voters at the expense of helping people who are fleeing war and persecution. And that is fundamentally wrong. And I think, and I really hope that this book and the story of Doha will do something to contribute. You know, the United States has a wonderful tradition of taking in refugees. It does, and it has over the years.
Unless you were Chinese for a long time.
You know, there have been waves and problems and discrimination, but, you know, the U.S. has been a leader in refugee protection and refugee resettlement and also donating to the organizations like UNHCR that help refugees. And we would hate to see that reversed because this is what has made this country a wonderful and rich and diverse and thriving place.
How did you wind up being spokesperson for the UNHCR? You studied German as an undergrad and then got a graduate degree in broadcast journalism.
Yeah,
why aren't you writing? I mean, I understand that all of that probably helped you in writing this book, but you are not covering the story for newspapers or magazines.
Yeah. You know, I've always been interested in international affairs, and I even worked for the International Atomic Energy Agency on nuclear nonproliferation and nuclear security as a communicator. And I have to say, when I moved to UNHCR, that this is the organization and the cause that gripped my heart. There are over 60 million people in this world today who have been forced to flee from their homes, and they don't really have a voice.
60 million?
Yes.
Wow.
It is the largest number of people, the biggest forced displacement since World War II. And you know, they need help. And it's, I'm proud and honored to be working for this cause and to doing what I can to give voice to people who have lost everything.
We're very focused on the Middle East, but there are also many people fleeing terrible situations in Central America.
Yes, also, yes. What's a new phenomenon in a way, what you see in Central America is people are fleeing gang violence. It's not a war per se, but this does qualify people. If your life is in danger, if you're about to be murdered, you know, you do have a right to seek asylum. And we're seeing that a lot of people, children, women, are also coming to this country and trying to seek asylum. You have people fleeing for other reasons, too. We have, you know, the terrorism and extremism that are, you know, the kind of war situation is no longer black and white. So, you know, they're fleeing all kinds of different situations. And I think it's our duty, if we cannot stop, if we're not going to engage as countries meaningfully to prevent and to stop the conflicts, the violence that are driving so many people from their homes, then at least the minimum what we can do is help the victims.
On average, refugees spend 17 years in exile, so that means they want to go back home.
I have never met a refugee that doesn't want to go back home.
You gave a TED talk. We don't have much time, but you mentioned in it that you often ask refugees what they've taken with them when they leave Syria. What kinds of things do they say?
Well, the one that I featured in my TED talk is a young, he was an 18-year-old named Hani, and he told me when I asked him, what did you take when you had to flee when the bombs were falling in homes and your parents came into your room and said, we have to leave now, Hani? And he just looked at me, and then he, without any question, and he said, I took my high school diploma. And he went and ran, and he got the diploma, and it was covered in this beautiful silk cloth, and he showed it to me. And he said, this is my future. And nothing else had any meaning. And so that's why I ask refugees, what did they, you know, all of this, the possessions and things like that don't mean anything. It's what's going to help them in the future.
Melissa Fleming will be speaking with Brandon Stanton of Humans of New York tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. They'll be talking about her book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, The Journey of Doa Al-Zamel, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival, published by Flatiron Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was such a pleasure to be here.